Hello and welcome to New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. Every program, we pick a new book that's especially interesting and chat with the author about the book. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Cambiz Ganabisiri, professor of religion at Reed College, about his new book, A History of Islam in America, From the New World to the New World Order. Despite the fact that many American Muslim families have lived in the United States for generations, they are often thought of as foreigners. I have on occasion seen people ask African-American Muslims, for example, when they converted to Islam or what drew them to the religion, or asking Muslims from Middle Eastern or Asian descent where they're from or when they came to America. It's surprising for some people to find out that these people are neither converts or immigrants. There are sometimes second, third, fourth generation Muslims living in America. I don't think people are trying to be malicious when they ask these types of questions. But it does underscore some of the assumptions we have in popular discourse about American Muslims. That is to say, Muslims are new members of the United States, whether through immigration or conversion. Cambiz does an excellent job of showing that Muslims in America have a long history. He's able to accomplish this with great success because of both his strong training in Islamic studies, but also in American religious history. Because of this, he's able to transcend a flat, monolithic presentation of American Muslims that's often offered in the current politicized discursive dichotomy between Islam and the West. A History of Islam in America is an essential read for anyone interested in Islam in America or American religious history. So let's hear what he had to say.
Today we're here with Cambiz Ganabisiri. We're going to be talking about his new book, A History of Islam in America, From the New World to the New World Order, which came out in 2010 with Cambridge University Press. Cambiz, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great. Yeah, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yeah, I was really happy to get the book and read it over. I think you're adding a lot to the conversation. I wasn't expecting you to be as theoretically rich and methodologically thorough. I was expecting some more portraits of prominent Muslim Americans. So I think you're really changing the way you approach Islam in America, and I think it's for the better. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Before we get into the book, maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I was born in Tehran, Iran, and immigrated with my family to the United States during the Iran-Iraq War. I went to Claremont McKenna College to do an undergraduate degree in religious studies, and then became really interested in religion as a way in which people think about their worlds and shape their worlds. And then went on to graduate school to work both on American religious history and early Islamic and modern Islamic intellectual and social history in the Middle East primarily.
And how did, I know you've been working on Islam in America for a while.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into this specific project?
There's a really interesting story behind that. When I was in college, I wrote my senior thesis on Muslims in Los Angeles, which later on I revised while I was in graduate school and published as a book called Competing Visions of Islam in the United States, a Study of Los Angeles. And at that time, there wasn't much done on Muslims in America, hence, you know, people like me being able to publish their senior thesis as a book with an academic press. But I noticed that when I was working on Muslims in America, that everyone who was writing or thinking about Muslims in America was not trained in American religious history. And as a student of religion who was interested in Islam, I was very well aware that because Islam had generally been studied up until very recently in area studies departments, it wasn't really part of a larger conversation about religion more generally. We've had theorists to work on Islam like Geertz and Wilford Canwell Smith being influential in the study of religion, but Islam as a religion hadn't really shaped all the analytical categories that I studied as a student of religion. And I was concerned that if you have people writing on American Islam who haven't been trained in American religious history, that the history will repeat itself and that people would look at them. larger context or the context in which they're living their lives, but rather that they would become marginalized to larger discussions of American history and the history in which they're actually participating. And so when I was going to graduate school, I wanted to study Islam primarily, and like most people get my solid foundation in Islamic studies, but I also wanted to study American religious history with the idea of writing this book eventually. And so I minored in American religious history with Professor Bill Hutchison in particular, who was a major influence in the way in which I came to think about Muslims in America more generally, and think about religion and religious history more generally. And also worked with Roy Motahede and William Graham, who are also very influential in the way in which I began to think about how we as scholars of religion could not just talk about people through our own theoretical lenses, but also examine the ways in which they act on their worlds and they shape their own worlds. So after graduating from graduate school at Harvard, from leaving Harvard, it was right around 9/11, and I was contacted by Cambridge University Press to see if I would be interested in writing something on Islam in America. And I told them that essentially, I haven't been working on this material for a while. Right now, I'm very busy working on early 9th and 10th century Islamic intellectual history and conceptions of justice there. So, I haven't been doing this, and if I was going to do something, this is what I would do, that I would want to take on a historical approach. And the editor wrote back and said, wonderful, let's, send me a proposal and let's do this. And I ended up putting a proposal together. And interestingly, when the blind reviews came back, they all sort of insisted that Dr. Ghana Basiri knows about Muslims since the 1960s. He should be focusing on that, and why, not focusing so much on this longer history. And after seeing those reviews, I thought the editor was not going to publish the book because they insisted that the book be essentially about Muslims since the 1960s. And I told the editor that wasn't the book I was interested in writing. And she ended up contacting me and saying, no, just give me your justification for what it is you want to do and we'll move forward with it. And that's how the book came about. And given the positive reception it's received so far, I feel redeemed in many ways for sticking to my guns and not having only 20 pages be about the rest of the history of Muslims in America and the rest about Muslims in America since the 1960s.
Yeah, I think you've added a real lot. It's very rich. As far as the way you kind of frame the book, there's a few kind of theoretical and methodological things I wanted to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
First, maybe you could kind of explain this term American Islam.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, this is problematic. I think in the book, you describe this very clearly. So if you could just explain the use of American Islam.
Yeah, it's problematic for several reasons. One is that it suggests that there are local Islams, and in Islamic studies we've had this turn in the 70s, and where a lot of anthropologists proposed that we can't really understand Islam as a global movement, given the enormous diversity that exists among Muslims, and we ought to think about Muslims in terms of in terms of plurals, so Islams rather than Islam. And for many, the phrase American Islam suggests this, that we ought to think about Islam in regional terms. And of course, that becomes problematic because Muslims themselves don't understand their practices, even though they're local practices or their universal ideas being put into practice or in regional context. They don't understand their religion in that way. They understand it as a universal religion. So some have problems with the phrase for that reason. Others, it also for some suggests this sort of triumphalism of American triumphalism that we're familiar with, and I don't use it in that sense at all, and I don't think of it in that sense at all. And I try in the book to say, that what we are witnessing is what I call American Islam is a particular type of establishment, institution building and community building that has had a long history in the United States, and I tried to in the book trace this history, the continuity that exists in community and institution building in the United States among Muslims, that gives the Islamist practice in the United States particular contours, and I tried to trace those contours in the book. And I think it's fair to call those particular contours that Islam has had historically in America and American Islam, and not in the sense to say that American Islam is somehow different from Egyptian Islam or in theological terms, or that it's to belittle it in a sense to say that, you know, oh, this is what they do in America. This is Americanized Islam as opposed to like the true Islam of a heartland or anything of that sort, which I don't think are assertions that could be theoretically justified, but rather as a way to say that there has been a historical continuity in the way in which Muslims have practiced their religion in the United States, and that could be identified and seen as American Islam.
I'm wondering if you could discuss also the problems with the framing in American Islam and the current politicized dichotomy between Islam and the West. You discussed a little bit about some of the previous scholarship on this, and I'm wondering how your book challenges this model.
Thank you for bringing that up. That was actually one of the main reasons why I ended up writing this book, because a lot of the work that had been done by people who were not specialists in American religious history on Muslims in America had been done by sociologists and anthropologists who were mainly concerned about issues of assimilation, sort of assuming this dichotomy between Islam and the West, and then asking, well, how are Muslims getting along in the United States? How are they faring in the United States? You know, what happens when Muslims want to cover their hair, or what happens, not to be too facetious, but, you know, when they go to the bathroom and there's no water for them to clean themselves, or as Islamic law, ritual purity laws require, and so on. And there was such a hung up on questions of assimilation, which I think to some degree is fair enough, because that's a concern that people generally have, that what we were missing was the fact that the history of Islam in America, the history of Muslims in America, by the virtue of the fact that people were Muslims and living in the West, challenges this binary between Islam and the West, and that has come to shape the way in which people think about Islam generally since the 19th century, at least. And it challenges the dichotomy between Islam and modernity that we see in scholarship throughout the 19th and 20th century. And it forces us to rethink, actually, the relationship between Islam and modernity. And I saw in many ways a missed opportunity that if we, rather than looking at the experiences of Muslims, which they went about interpreting the religion in an American context, in a quote-unquote Western context, rather than challenging our existing frameworks for thinking about Islam and modernity, we're reinforcing them by asking questions about how Muslims are faring, when in actuality, Muslims have fared very well and have been here for a very long time and haven't had the issues that many scholars have thought that they would be concerned with or that would be problematic for them when they're asking questions about how Muslims are assimilating. And my hope really was that the book would set up a framework where we could do a lot more scholarship and rethink the larger narratives of the relationship between Islam and modernity.
Another one of the approaches you take in the book, as opposed to a lot of scholarship which focus on biographies of individual Muslims, especially in the earlier period, you focus on communal relations, or what you call encounters and exchanges, and then the role of institutions. Why do you think these are important and effective in showing kind of a more dynamic history of Islam in America?
The first is a lot of the work that has been done on the history of Muslims in America is focused on African Muslims who were enslaved in what eventually became the United States. And, these some of these works were published 25, 30 years ago, but they didn't really have much of an impact on the way in which people thought about slavery, the way in which they thought about the relationships, Muslims' relationship to the United States, even in that period. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that the focus on these were on individual Muslims, because that's all the evidence that we have. We had individual Muslims in the antebellum and colonial period who stood out by virtue of the fact that white Christians took interest in them, by virtue of the fact that they were literate. And their stories then became these sort of quaint stories that we could look at, sort of local histories of some sort that we could look at, even though their lives actually were representative of this larger exchange between and encounters between West Africa, Western Europe, Western European empires, particularly the French, the British, then the Spanish, and the Americas. And their lives were actually, tracing their lives was personified these relationships, but that was all lost in the way in which most of the scholarship focused on these individuals as sort of quaint Muslims. Like, you know, Grant, for example, wrote this book called The Fortunate Slave, where it became a sort of a quaint story about one individual, even though that individual's life personified all sorts of interesting transatlantic relations. And for me as a student of religion, I think religion is always defined in relationship to one another. You know, it's not until there's, you know, you can't have Islam without Christianity. You can't have religions in the plural. You can't have religion in the singular and religions in the plural, that they're always in relationship to one another, and that the process of distinguishing one group, one religious group from another, always requires some form of recognition, some form of recognition of religion from which religions in the plurals is derived. So I thought what I was really interested in wasn't so much what these individuals had done, whether it be during times of slavery or whether it be in the early 20th century, but rather how their lives personify these relations that sort of grand narratives of modernity and the grand narratives of American history have overlooked. While in actuality, it was really these relations that shaped American history and came to shape the way in which Americans came to understand themselves and distinguish themselves from the quote-unquote old world. So because of my interest as a student of religion, the relationality of religion, this is one of those things that I think the history of Islam in America contributes to larger theoretical discussions of modernity and religion in particular, that religions are always in relationship and being defined in relation to one another. I was much more interested in how it was that, even if I looked at vignettes or individuals, how it is that they represented a larger relational history than simply quaint stories about particular individuals or particular events in time. And, you know, in some ways, I wasn't sure exactly what I find when I go through my sources with this eye, but I was shocked to find this very interesting transnational story of Islam and America that most people don't know about.
In the first two chapters, you focus on this early period, and kind of two of these themes you talk about for early enslaved African Muslims is denegrification and de-Islamization. Could you discuss these two terms and how they relate?
One of these two terms that I was introducing in the text that I spent a lot of time thinking about and worrying about their introduction. And by denegrification, what I was trying to capture was this notion that certain Blacks, because or Africans, because they were found to be Muslims, came to be distinguished from other Africans, because and the the way in which they were portrayed by the white Americans who had encounters with them or wrote about them or tried to preserve aspects of the history, they were distinguished from the stereotypical characteristics that were often given to Africans, such as, a particular type of curly hair and, certain facial features, and these Africans, even though they shared all of those characteristics with other Africans, by virtue of the fact that they were identified as Muslims, had to be seen as somehow different from the rest of Africans to justify them. And this is sort of what I tried to identify as a liminal space through which then the relationship between white Americans and Black Africans could be renegotiated and redefined. And in particular, it was defined historically by seeing these Africans as sort of semi-civilized people, because they knew how to read and write, because they were seen as being part of a larger Islamic civilization. They were seen as individuals who stood between the uncivilized African and the civilized Christian, American Christian, and then they could act as bridges of sorts and occupy this liminal space between these two groups in order to redefine America's relationship to Africa and eventually with slavery. And similarly with while Islam was used as a way of denigrifying, to disassociate Black slaves from negative characteristics that were stereotypically associated with Africans, there was also a process by which acceptance of these groups meant that they had to then also disassociate themselves from, be disassociated from Islam. And this was often done by saying that these individuals had converted, even though people very well knew that they hadn't converted, or especially, for example, one particular character, Abdurrahman, when people were trying to get support for his repatriation to Africa, they presented them as a convert to Christianity. And when some Southerners were concerned about the fact that he was being used as a way of bemoaning slavery and for anti-slavery propaganda, they began to describe him as a bloodthirsty Muslim. So that these characterizations of individuals as either Islamic or Black, or their disassociation from certain characteristics, stereotypes that are associated with Blacks and Muslims, a way of defining these individuals in a liminal context, so that they could serve as intermediaries. And I don't think I pushed the envelope here as far as it could go, because this, I think, raises all sorts of interesting questions about race in America more generally, because we continue to see this process in the early 20th century when certain Black Americans themselves in the Moorish Science Temple and in the Nation of Islam use Islam in similar ways to distinguish themselves from Blacks, and in particular to distinguish themselves as constituting by saying that they constitute a new national identity. One that's Islamic, one that's not, not associated with the stigmatized stereotypes of the "quote unquote" Negro, and I hope other scholars in the future will pick these strands up and follow them and trace them through.
Yeah, I think they're good kind of framing terms to approach these. Also, during this early period, you talk about the diversity of practices and how that affects the limits of the community, I guess. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Yeah. One of the other sort of features of the scholarship on Muslims in colonial and antebellum America has been that Muslims have been seen as sort of survivals, African survivals in America. So that, by that I mean that they have been seen as African elements that could survive in the United States, the aspects of African culture that survive in the United States and come to affect a particular type of African American culture. Alternatively, they've been seen as the practice of Islam and as it was seen as a form of resistance against white supremacy and slavery. And this assumed generally that communal boundaries that Muslims tried to create through their practices were exclusive as communal boundaries, so that they maintained a distinct Islamic identity in this American context as a form of resistance and opposition to slavery and white supremacy. If you actually look at the practices much more closely, you find that being in an American context, and they're actually being used as ways of redefining the practice, continues to define communal boundaries, but redefines them in American context in a way that includes both non-Muslim Africans and non-Muslim African Americans, and in some cases, whites. The practice of Islam was used as a way of being able to define new communal boundaries. And this was particularly, I think, easier for Muslims because already Islam gives Muslims an interpretation of other religions. So Jews and Christians become people of the book, and they're not, and that already provides a way by which Muslims could enter into some sort of communion with them. One of the examples I give is this wonderful character, Omar ibn Said, who talks about reading the Bible and the Quran at the same time, and talks about his own understandings of God in a way that interspersed both the New Testament and the Quran together, and goes back and forth between them to sort of identify new religious his religious identity in a way that both recognizes him as distinctly Islamic and recognizes him as being in communion with his master, the Owens, the Owen family, which he seemed to like because of how well they treated him. Similarly, we find practices that were done with distribution of rice cakes as form of sadaqa or alms of sorts, sacrificial alms of sorts, where Muslims were doing this to commemorate Islamic practices while entering into sharing these rice cakes with non-Muslims. They were entering into a new communal relationship with their own companions who happen to be non-Muslim black slaves, African and African American. So that there seems to be a lot more going on in the way in which Islam was practiced than simply exercising a form of resistance. This doesn't mean that people weren't, by practicing Islam, also challenging social hierarchies and racism, but it seems that there was also more going on. And I think that's important because then we could see that Black Muslims were participating in the creation of an African-American culture and an African-American religion in ways that hasn't been recognized, I think, at least in the 19th century. They weren't always seeing themselves as being distinct from other slaves or whites.
You then move in the book to the post-Civil War era, and the way in which you frame this, and you do this really well in every chapter, you really give a good contextualization of what's going on in American religion. Mm-hmm. And for this chapter, you focus on race, religion, and progress. Could you discuss how that relates to the American identity of the time?
This story has been told in many ways, and I think I used the World Parliament of Religions in 1893 as a way of exemplifying this, and I talk about this as a conflation that occurs to define an American national identity, where the sort of Anglo-Saxon race and Protestant religion and progress are all conflated with one another to define a national identity that unites Americans and celebrates American American values and the establishment of American industry. The word conflate is not exactly historically accurate because they themselves didn't see race and religion and progress as being separate categories that could be conflated together. So they saw them as being all intermingled, but we could look at them as different separate categories that they can conflate it to sort of justify Anglo-Saxon supremacy and to define at a time in which America was becoming increasingly diverse, not only because of the emancipation of slaves, but also because of increased immigration from Southern Europe and increased immigration of Catholics and Jews into the United States, the annexation of territories in which both French Catholic and Spanish Catholics lived in the United States. So these Latin American communities, all of it was raising all sorts of questions about the nature of America's national identity. And the argument that seems to have won out in the late 19th century in the post-Civil War era was this one that saw America as essentially an Anglo-Saxon nation that was able to attain the progress and the scientific and industrial advancements that it had attained because of its values, which were identified with Protestantism. And this comes for a very long time to shape America's national identity, and it becomes extremely influential also for American Muslims, particularly Blacks, who come to use Islam in a similar way to read themselves into American modernity in a way that so that the Black race and Islam and progress go hand in hand in a way to find a Black national identity that I think we find blatantly and clearly in the Moorish Science Temple and the Nation of Islam.
You also use, I think even though these figures are rather different, use Alexander Russell Webb and Immanuel Kant to kind of exemplify the role of certain types of people during the late 19th century. Could you discuss these two figures?
Yeah, and for them, we could see how influential this was in the way in which people thought about religion more generally. Muhammad Alexander Webb was a diplomat who converted to Islam in 1892, and there was sort of recruited by these Indian businessmen to propagate Islam in the United States, and he belonged to the Theosophical societies and was primarily interested in theosophy, and as a result of reading certain Sufi texts, comes to be interested in Islam and converts to Islam, even though most theosophists saw that Islam is too particularly monotheistic and doctrinaire for it to be taken seriously and interpreted according to theosophical thought. And what's interesting about Webb is that Webb thinks that he's able, because what he's able to identify in Islam so nicely correlates with what he saw as sort of American values of open-mindedness and liberality, he thought that he would soon be successful in propagating Islam in America. And then what he actually finds out is that most Americans didn't think that was possible at all, and sort of only talked about him in using ways. And Kant was an interesting figure who also comes into the United States in the early 20th century and finds that there's this interest in traditional Christian religion, what he identifies as a form of more universal spirituality of sorts, that at that time was, because of the influence of the Theosophists in large part, was being associated with Hinduism and Buddhism. And as a Hindu, he goes and talks in some of the temples that were associated with Vivekananda. Finds that although people are interested in his message of Sufism, they're not particularly they're wary of the association of Sufism with Islam, and comes to completely disassociate himself from Islam to identify himself as a Sufi master and disassociate Sufism as a form of universal teaching that just accidentally happens to be associated with Islam in order to be able to propagate his message in the United States. And he encounters another aspect of this sort of conflation of race, religion, and progress because of his darker skin. He was and because he was from India, he was detained, for example, upon one of his return trips from Europe to the United States, and had to be taken from immigration officials by one of his followers, and specifically talks about the problem of race in America that he saw as betraying other American ideals of equality and progress. And both of them, so instantiate this, or I talk about them in the book, instantiating the effects of this, the both the enormous popularity and the effects of this conflation of race, religion, and progress in the United States.
In the next chapter, you talk about the early 20th century, mm-hmm. and you talk about the relationship between race, ethnicity, religion, and citizenship. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about kind of some of what's going on in the early 20th century and how these relate to each other?
Yeah, in the early 20th century, we get the immigrants coming from Anatolia, Eastern Europe, and South Asia to the United States in relatively significant numbers. And one of the first people to actually figure out what percentage of how many of these immigrants were Muslims. Generally, Muslims were minority of the small part of the larger immigrant populations that came from these regions. And I think there were about 60, from what I have been able to estimate, about 60,000 of these immigrants from these regions up until World War I were probably Muslim. and as they, so, the, again, the United States began, has to figure out, well, put that differently, these new immigrants had to figure out how their own stories fit into the larger history of Islam, larger history of America. And here ethnicity comes to play a much more prominent role in people's lives than religion does, in part because I think that the Islam could not have been seen as being part of a larger American narrative at this time. So a lot of the Muslims who came either dissimulated, they didn't talk about themselves as Muslims, they changed their names, they didn't say that they were Muslims, so that because they're afraid that if they do, they wouldn't be allowed entry into the United States. And some were actually denied entry into the United States because of a law that indicated that and that said that anyone who believes in the practice of polygamy or the validity of the practice of polygamy should be barred from entry into the United States, and some Muslims were identified, some people were identified as Muslims, were denied entry into the United States, and at this time also, as America was trying to figure out its own national identity, and vis-a-vis its own citizenship laws, there are laws passed that denied citizenship to people who are neither black or white, which raised a particularly interesting question for many, are Arabs, for example, white, or are they black, or are South Asians, because they're Caucasian, or should they be considered white, or should they be considered black? And the reason for this was that the citizenship laws first gave citizenship to, in 1792, people who were white. And then after the emancipation, that law was changed to include blacks into include blacks as citizens of the United States also, which then meant that anyone who is considered to be part of the quote-unquote Mongolian races or would not be eligible for citizenship. And this mobilized a lot of immigrant Muslims to begin to think again of themselves in more ethnic terms rather than in religious terms. And so a lot of Arab Muslims came to associate with other Arab communities much more than they did with Muslim communities. I think order themselves communally and institutionally around an Arab national Arab ethnic identity rather than an Arab Muslim identity or a Muslim identity. Similarly with South Asians and so on. And I trace in the book this sort of ways in which they try to interpret their own ethnic identities to say that they're white so that they could be included as citizens in the United States. And for the most part, Arabs were successful in doing this, arguing that they should be considered white in part because they came from the Holy Land where Jesus himself was, and would the United States deny citizenship to Jesus? And South Asians, because of their skin color, even though there were all sorts of more scientific arguments or so-called scientific arguments were made about South Asians being Caucasians, because of their skin color, they were denied citizenship up until the liberalization of the citizenship laws, immigration laws in the 1950s and 60s.
You then move to institutions and organizations and how these play a role in what you call rooting Islam in America. Can you talk about some of these, either these groups or these institutions?
Yeah, one of the things that was particularly interesting is already we see the in the attempts that Muslims made, and a lot of immigrants from South Asia and the Middle East made to identify themselves as to be able to identify themselves as white to claim citizenship in the United States, and was this attempt. To claim their own experiences, claim America for themselves. And we see this sort of go on hyperdrive in the post-World War II period. And in between, in this post-World War II period and the earlier period when people were arguing for citizenship rights, we find this several decades of Americans turning away from turning away from just simply seeing themselves as sojourners in the United States to begin to root themselves in the in America and begin to establish mosques and funerary associations. And I argue that in particular this was done when their earlier immigrants died and they wanted to, and some of them died without families, and their families or their friends wanted them to be able to receive an Islamic burial, which led to the formation of funerary associations, which later then led to the formation of mosques and the sort of recognition that there was a need to begin to build Islamic institutions in the United States, given that there were now a sizable Muslim communities in this interwar period in the United States. Associations were mainly the funerary associations that were often associated with particular ethnic communities. That's not so much true in a place like Detroit, where Turks, Kurds, and Arabs interacted with one another as Muslims in the funerary association, the Muslim funerary associations. But in the West Coast, for example, they're mainly South Asian. So these institutions that they began building to begin to root Islam in America were funerary associations and mosques. And at the same time, we have the Moorish Science Temple and the Nation of Islam that I had mentioned before, beginning to develop and institutionalize an understanding of a Black national identity to which Islam Islam was an inherent part of. And Islam was claimed as a way. Islam was claimed as a way by which blacks could define a separate identity from the stigmatized black identity of the time, to read African Americans into the narrative of American modernity and American progress. And this was mainly done by African American migrants from the South to to the North, who arrives in the North expecting that they would find an context and atmosphere in which racism would not be as prevalent, but they found out otherwise and found that they need to develop ways by which they could think of them, begin to help themselves. And helping oneself was an important, very important aspect of both the ideology of the Nation of Islam and the Moorish Science Temple.
In the next chapter, you move to the 60s to the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's kind of a watershed moment in 1965, the Immigration and Nationality Act. Could you tell us what a post-1965 looks like for the diversity of Muslim community?
After the liberalization of the Immigration Act, of immigration laws with the Immigration Act of 1965, the purpose behind this was that there were quotas before that restricted immigration from Asia and Africa to the United States, essentially any and Southern Europe into the United States. The liberalization of these laws got rid of these quotas, these racist quotas, and the expectation was that after World War II, Southern Europeans would want to join their families in the United States, and most Southern Europeans, though, stayed put. And the people who actually ended up coming to the United States were mainly from Asia and Africa. And this completely diversified the Muslim community, and also increased the number of Muslim communities in the United States by tenfold. So 1960s and 70s, we have about a million people from Muslim majority countries coming to the United States. And in this case, now there were Muslims were the majority among these immigrants. Beginning with the 1960s, we find that America becomes slowly a microcosm of the global Muslim community. That every Muslims from every part of the world come to be represented in the United States, and for the future Muslims within the 1980s and 1990s, and Muslim leaders who are forming national Muslim associations, they had to figure out a way of being able to make sense of this diversity, to be able to articulate a new understanding of Islam that made sense of this diversity of Muslims and articulated an identity that went beyond traditional identities that may be associated like South Asia or Lebanon or other parts of the Muslim world. The other aspect of the way in which the immigration laws in 1965 diversified the American Muslim community was immediately after the World War II period, Muslims began to build national institutions for the first time. So the institutions that were built in the interwar period were mainly local institutions or mosques and funerary associations that served the local community. There was very little activity among there's a wonderfully interesting figure named Sati Majid who was interested in national community building among Muslims in the interwar period between World War I and World War II. But other than him, there doesn't seem to have been much activity in terms of national activity among Muslims. But after World War II, American Muslims began to, they had gone just like Chinese Americans and Black Americans who had gone abroad and fought for freedom abroad. When they came home, they weren't going to accept secondary citizenship status back in the United States. So they began to organize themselves in ways to be able to claim their American identity and their rights in America as citizens. There's a movement that to build. To bring local communities under a federation of sorts. And this movement comes and gets the name Federation of Islamic Associations in the United States and Canada. And it was mainly led and founded by veterans of World War II, Arab American veterans of World War II. And these activists, Muslim activists, were very much concerned with the practice of Islam as it had developed in the United States up until this time. After 1965, we get a new community, actually beginning with the late 1950s when students began to come, Muslim students also began to come to the United States in large numbers. But definitely after 1965, we get a new group of Muslims coming to the United States, a group that had been very much politicized by anti-colonial movements in their own homelands, who came already very politicized to the United States with the idea of establishing pure Islam, a form of Islam that's embedded in that's solely embedded in the Quran and the Hadith. That's what I call it, sort of a puritanical Islam, and organizing themselves around these notions of Islam, and strewing ethnic identity and national identities all as being unimportant before this singular Muslim identity that was founded, that should be founded on the Quran and the Hadith. And these groups began to change the character of national organizations in the United States slowly through the formation of the Muslim Student Association, from which several other national Muslim organizations break away, the Islamic Circle of North America that breaks away in the 1970s, the Islamic Society of North America, which was founded in the early 1980s and is actually a part of the Muslim Student Association that takes on a new form. But even the Muslim Society of America, and the Muslim American Society, I'm sorry, MAS, that gets formed in the 1990s, had its roots all in the MSA. So we find both greater diversity in terms of race and ethnicity in the United States after 1965, and great diversification of sort of beliefs about Islam, and particularly the introduction of these sort of puritanical understandings of Islam that then come to dominate a lot of the national organizations. Now, one of the things that's interesting often when talk about this issue with American Muslims, and they often want to say that, well, you know, didn't Islam really come to America in the post after 1965 when these groups came? Before that, you know, what they did was this quaint thing that we talked about before. It was an Americanized Islam that wasn't really important. Of course, they're expressing their own sort of normative understandings of Islam, to which I don't want to really speak, but what's interesting is that when the Muslim Student Association is founded, it models itself in very much like the Federation of Islamic Associations, in which it had been involved before. People who founded the Muslim Student Association or the MSA were involved in the Federation of Islamic Association before the founding of the MSA. And, you know, rather than founding a very sort of centralized organization like the FIA, they found a federation of sorts. They give a lot of local autonomy to local branches. They see themselves as sort of facilitators rather than people who could dictate what it is that the rest of Muslims ought to do. So even though they themselves, the original founders, often had these sort of much more puritanical visions of Islam, the practices that of individual branches of MSA were wide and varied and reflected local, the local Muslim communities and their needs and their understandings of Islam. So whatever one may think of the degree to which, you know, at one point we could normatively say Islam came to the United States organizationally, institutionally, in terms of community building, we see this continuity from the way in which American Muslims began to think about how to institutionalize and root Islam in America into a war period, all the way to the formation of the MSA and the Islamic Society of North America.
Now, there's really a lot in the book that we're skipping, and so I apologize for the time. But before I let you go, I really want to ask you about what's your vision of the post 9/11 American national identity and where Muslims fit into that.
I'm really, really glad you asked me about that. Interesting about the place of Muslims in this sort of new world order that we're in now after the end of the Cold War. It's complicated, and I'm not sure where it's going to go exactly, because while America has assimilated and dealt with a lot of immigrants from a lot of different countries with varying types of varying religions, this is the first time which America has had to figure out not only its national identity, but its role in the world as a sole superpower in the world in relationship with these communities within its own border. So that America is trying to figure out not only its national identity, but its role in the world as a whole, as a sole superpower, when it has in the is in direct conflict with Muslims immediately after at the end of the Cold War. Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait, and resulted in the first Gulf War of 1990-91, where America's first actions as a sole superpower brought it into conflict with a Muslim-majority country. Then in 1993, we had the World Trade Center bombings in New York City, which raised also some questions about what role Muslims could play in America's in American multicultural in a multicultural America. Where would Muslims fit? Can they be trusted? Given that that attack was undertaken by Muslims who had lived in the Muslims who had lived in the United States. So we're in a very difficult and complex time, and it's perilous for a historian to say what I see as happening in the future, to predict what would happen in the future. But what's clear is that America's national identity since the early 1990s is being defined in relationship to Muslims very clearly. Well, in the past, maybe individual Muslims' lives or particular institutions may have instantiated the way in which American national identity was defined more broadly. Now, America's national identity is being defined in relationship to Muslims, which has led us to this sort of very unusual place where whatever Muslims wear, how they look, what they say, all becomes a matter of not just religion or personal choice, but a matter of national security, a matter of loyalty, a matter of citizenship. And we find that today in this post 9/11 very, very prominently among Muslims in America, that they see themselves as ambassadors. Every person, Muslim, comes to see themselves as representing a larger group, even though that may not, shouldn't be really the case. Sure if I have a specific vision for where things are going to go, but I'm hopeful, particularly because of what we saw when this whole controversy around the mosque in Lower Manhattan came up, where we found American Muslims in their own voices on the national stage talking about what it meant to them to be American, defending freedom of religion, defending the First Amendment for the rest of Americans. And that for me suggests that, I think maybe 10 years from now, when we look back to that controversy, that might be what stands out the most for us. So that gives me some reason to be hopeful.
Also, just briefly, what do you think needs to be done for us to better understand the history of Muslims in America? What kind of approaches, maybe what topics do you think are going to be important?
I think one thing that needs to definitely be done is sort of preservation of Muslims' history. So archiving, I think, is important. There are a lot of families that have been in the United States, Muslim families that have been influential and in the United States, or families of people who founded mosques and have been activists in the United States, who have stuff sitting in their attics and important things that should be archived and maintained. I think so that just in a very logistical, practical way, it's really important. And I hope people would undertake it. Some places have already begun to do this. University of Michigan has begun to do this. Purdue University, Edward Curtis at Purdue, had been trying to do this for a while, and I hope others do this, making this stuff available, making it so that people themselves, Americans themselves, could go back to these sources and see them and understand and read them and interpret them for themselves, and contextualize them in the larger history of religion in America. But I think maybe where the future and where things I hope goes, and where I think where we sit from with the immediate future, the near future of the study of Islam in America stands is in the way in which it highlights the relationality of histories, both between the Muslim majority world and Europe and America, and between religions, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Islam, and so on. And I think methodologically, we could look to the history of Islam in America and Muslims in America to develop ways, methods by which we could understand relations, relational histories better, where we could tell transnational stories better and understand the way in which transnational ties have been influential in shaping how it is that American history has evolved and how American national identity has developed. People have begun to do this already in the study of the East Asians in the United States, the study of Buddhists, for example, Buddhist people have begun to do this. And I think that's where a lot more work needs to be done and where there's a lot more for thought.
Well, we've taken a lot of your time. Before you go, though, could you tell us about what you're working on now?
Yeah, I have several projects on my plate. One of the ones that's particularly relevant to this book was that I was surprised to find out that the first book-length study of Muslims in America that was written was published in 1960 out of Egypt and in Arabic. And I didn't expect this at all when I was doing the research for this book. And what I found there was that in the 1960s, as the sort of these transnational Muslim organizations were being developed, such as the OIC and the Muslim World League, they were very much interested in Muslim minority communities, as modernist Muslim ideas could not take root in Muslim majority nation states. They're very much looking to these Muslim minority communities as representative of the hope for the future of Islam. They saw these communities as being able to represent this sort of puritanical Islam that we were talking about, because they would be able to do, Muslim minority communities would be able to divorce Islam from culture and be able to practice a sort of a pure Islam. And I'm interested in pursuing this line further to see what it is that organizations like, and we all know that Muslim World League and OIC, you know, funded various organizations in the United States, but we don't know much about the ideology that went behind that. You know, there's always people talk about this sort of like a Saudi influence, but there seems to have been much more going on, that there was a way of thinking about religion more generally, religious pluralism more generally, that was going on in through these transnational organizations as they thought about the presence of Muslim minorities in both Western Europe and the United States. So I'm interested in tracing that and teasing that out more.
That sounds great. We hope you can talk to us more about that when it's done. Well, thank you again, Cambiz. We were talking to Cambiz Kanabasiri from Reed College in Oregon about his new book, A History in Islam in America, From the New World to the New World Order. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
So that was my interview with Cambiz Kanabasiri, professor of religion at Reed College, about his new book, A History of Islam in America, From the New World to the New World Order. I highly recommend it for anyone interested in American religious history or Islamic studies.